You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
From the hooded man with wires dangling from his arms to the naked human pyramid, the photographs taken by soldiers in Abu Ghraib prison have become defining symbols of a loss of a national moral compass in connection to the war in Iraq. What we haven't heard until now are the stories of the low-level soldiers who gave us those iconic photographs. For his latest book, called Standard Operating Procedure, Philip Gurevich draws on interviews and documents gathered by Errol Morris for the documentary of the same name. The book is published by the Penguin Press, and it is my great pleasure to welcome Philip Gurevich back to the show. Hi.
Hi, it's good to be with you.
What was your reaction when you first saw the photographs from Abu Ghraib?
I suspect, not that different from everybody else. I was shocked to see them. I was shocked that they existed, that there were photographs, as well as that the things that they showed were occurring in at least enough of a regularity that so many photographs could have been produced. I remember
finding... And we heard there were many more that we were never going to see.
We were told that. In the course of the investigation that is behind the book, I came to get the feeling that there probably aren't that many that at least by now we haven't seen. We saw a lot more in the for the book, and I'm not quite sure what some of those so much worse pictures were supposed to be, or whether they were just trying to in some way diminish the shock of the ones that we were looking at. But I remember seeing the ones of dogs and finding those particularly terrifying and appalling. I remember also that I was covering the 2004 presidential campaign at the time. And my response was very much that of many people. When we first saw these pictures, there was very little doubt, I think, in the public mind that these were pictures of something that was being done by America to its prisoners, that this was an expression of some sort of policy. One of the symptoms or expressions of that was that The Economist, a magazine that had supported the invasion of Iraq and the war there and much of the policy there, on its cover showed the picture of the hooded man right after the pictures came out with the headline, "Rumsfeld Resign." The connection between policy and the pictures was there. And then that got split off. And I remember while covering the campaign, assuming this would become a matter of great national debate, the nation's honor was at stake.
But you suggest in the book that the pictures actually helped George Bush's re-election.
I don't go that far. What I feel is that the pictures became a tremendous distraction. In a certain way, they went from being what seemed at first obviously an expose to allowing a distraction and to some degree a cover-up of the broader policy of torture and abuse that was very widespread. And they allowed the accountability, as it were, to be shifted from the idea that this was connected to the resignation of Rumsfeld or the policies of the administration and the policies of the military and the practices that had become standard, and saying, look at these depraved rogue soldiers. And basically, instead of the photograph serving as a window through which we entered into the world, which is what I've tried to do in telling the story myself, the photographs came to be a frame where anything that wasn't in the photographs we kind of forgot about.
And a running theme in Errol Morris's documentary is that the photographs don't tell the whole story. In fact, they can sometimes be more misleading than instructive. Why do you think that happened with these pictures?
Well, I think that it's complicated because on the one hand, the photographs did a tremendous public service. And I want to defend the photographs on that level, which is they were an expose. Without these photographs, we would not be having this conversation. We would not have an awareness of what went on at that prison, not just on the MI, military intelligence block, where those photographs were taken, but throughout the entire detention program in Iraq, which was full of outrages. And we would not really have had to reckon with this. If they were taken by photojournalists, those photographs would have been prize-winning scoops, no question. But at the same time...
And that was the intention of one of, or at least one of the
people involved.
One
of the photographers, Sabrina Harmon, specialist Sabrina Harmon, felt that she was taking these photographs in part to expose what she saw, and the phrase that she kept saying, what was allowed, to show what was allowed, to show what was allowed. But at the same time, the photographs, I think, are misleading, or basically there was a line that kept coming out in the first days that these photographs came out, and I think it was in one of Seymour Hersh's great scoops with which he broke the story was the line, "The photographs tell the whole story." And that's where we misled ourselves. Photographs are evidence of a larger story, but they're mute. They can't speak. We have to go through them and find the words to show what they show.
Is that why you chose not to include any of the photographs in the book?
Yeah, I felt that in telling the story, I wanted to break the frame that the photographs had to a large extent imposed on our sense of it up till now, and that it was important to hear the voices, which I find remarkable, of these soldiers, and to see the photographs in the context of the prison and the war and the policies, rather than to see all of those things in the context of the photographs. And of course, they're well known, they're available, you can find them online and elsewhere.
When the president said this was just the behavior of a few bad apples, or was it Donald Rumsfeld? I can't remember.
It's impossible to find the provenance of that line, but everybody knows it as the line of the administration.
And yet everybody I knew said, that's impossible. It can't be. Why has it just ended there?
It's a puzzle. I mean, to some extent, it's the result of a military determination not to push it further. There was the military.
But Congress could have done an investigation. Has
Congress could have done an investigation if there had been a second party in Congress at the time. As you may recall, in 2004, we were in the third or fourth year of a one-party state, and there was no opposition party. There were no investigations. Congress poked around at it a little bit and dropped it. In 2006, when the Democrats took control, it was with such a slim majority, and nobody really wanted to revisit this. So the investigations have all died on the vine, and there's been no accountability, certainly on a legal level, above the level of staff sergeant. The other reason, honestly, is this is our policy. It was presented, and this was part of the trick. The administration was able to say, whether it was the president or Rumsfeld or people in Congress who went and said, oh, how awful, how disgusting, I saw these pictures, they make me ill. These are sick individuals. Individuals, notice. And they push it all onto these individuals, even as they keep eroding the definition of torture, keep undermining the Geneva Conventions, and pushing that forward quite aggressively as what we should be doing, not what we should be backing away from.
And all of that is apparent. You, in fact, you've said when people ask you if you found the smoking gun, you say Abu Ghraib is the smoking gun. And yet it seems to me that until the film opened and your book came out, this had been a largely forgotten, well, not forgotten, but it's something that we weren't paying much attention to anymore.
I think there's something about this material. It makes you want to look away. Looking at the pictures, and that's another reason they're not in the book, they're repellent. And because they don't provide information outside themselves, once you've seen them, you start to think, all right, I've seen them. I am suitably disgusted and distressed. I know that it's somehow not just a picture of some rogue soldiers. I believe that even this reflects a depth to which our country has sunk in some places at some times. But what am I supposed to do with it? Where do I go with this? How do I respond to this? And what I've attempted to do is to try to create a story that shows the connection of all of this. And also, I guess one way that I put it is the debate that we've had, to the extent that we've had any debate, the discussions we've had, and much of one's visceral response is, why are our soldiers doing this to them, to our prisoners? Is this what we as a nation want to do to other people? And some people say, well, sure, you know, otherwise they'd be cutting our heads off or blowing up our buildings. And other people say there's no level in which we should let them define us that way. I guess another way of putting it is, maybe we should be thinking, is this what we want to be doing to ourselves? Is this the kind of nation that we want to become as we project our image into the world?
My guest is Philip Gurevich, who gets equal credit with Errol Morris for a book called Standard Operating Procedure, published by the Penguin Press. Now, you wrote the book.
I wrote the book.
And you wrote it based mostly on interviews that he did with the Bad Apples and a few other people?
Exactly. In the summer of 2006, about a year and a half ago, Errol started sending me these extraordinary transcripts of conversations that he'd been having, interviews for the film, and suggested that there was obviously a lot more material than you can fit in a two-hour film. He had hundreds of hours of interviews, and along the way, there were also a lot of documents that were collected. And so the idea was that I would write from this huge archive of material a book, and he would make his film, And it wouldn't be the film of the book or the book of the film, but an attempt for each of us to kind of grapple with the material in our own media.
So there's a lot in this book that isn't in the film.
There's a fair amount. There are characters, and I think that was another reason that Errol quite generously suggested that, you know, take this and see what you'd want to do with it. There are characters that he had spent a lot of time thinking about that he didn't see a place for in the film. There are two prison directors who, from Utah, correctional facility, correctional department, old hands at the American prison world, who were sent over in May of 2003 to do an assessment of the Iraqi prisons and who ended up finding and starting to refurbish Abu Ghraib. They're not in the film. They become the first two chapters of my book. There are others.
Well, talking about the refurbishment, when he was on the show recently, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez told me that the U.S. military was fully aware of the negative image Abu Ghraib prison had as a symbol of Saddam Hussein's brutality, but there were just too many prisoners, and they had no choice. The plan was to refurbish the prison. Initially, I guess some of the prisoners were kept in tents, but that the amount of money that they expected never came through.
Well, there was no question that funding was short, but I think Ricardo Sanchez is right now one of the people who has a lot to answer for and who's managed not to be held accountable in any meaningful way, and so has written a book saying that somehow, although he was the overall commander of ground forces in Iraq, all crimes that were committed by people below him and above him were not his business.
Well, he had a lot on his plate, he says.
I'm sure he did have a lot on his plate. He also issued all of rules of interrogation that authorized the exploitation of the Arab fear of dogs and nudity and stress positions and darkness and so forth. And his lawyers and his legal shop wanted what happened at Abu Ghraib to happen. So in terms of Abu Ghraib being refurbished, there was actually a debate. And in the summer of 2003, there were two overlapping currents, as you can recall. There was this notion at that time that there would be a civilian administration, the CPA and so forth, that would try to refurbish an Iraqi civilian criminal justice system for murderers and car thieves and pickpockets and what have you. And that the jail was originally refurbished with money for that end, for Iraqi administration. And then there was the military. And the military was conducting sweeps and rounding people up as it was confronting an escalating insurgency. They started using Abu Ghraib simultaneously with these tented camps, which they continued to keep most of the people there in tents. The people you see in the pictures who are indoors constitute a fraction of the people. There were about 90 people on the two tiers that we're talking about in the pictures, and there were like 9,000 in the tented camps at the peak of it. There was a current, a strong number of people in the military who strongly urged against using Abu Ghraib, not because of its symbolism merely, but because it stood at the heart of the Sunni triangle, at the heart of the insurgency, was it a very dangerous place to get to and a very dangerous place to stay.
Because they were lobbing mortar shells at it.
The place was literally shooting fish in a barrel. This was the barrel, the walls of the prison. It's a 280-acre ground, and they were being shelled day in and day out. Meanwhile, the camp where prisoners had been kept during the war, during the invasion phase, was a place called down in Qasr, which is the port city right on the Kuwaiti border out in the middle of the desert. Nobody would attack it because nobody lived around there. It was in the sand, and the idea was you could build a prison camp here forever and keep people quite secure and controlled, and it would have been a much better location.
But they didn't do that. Why?
They preferred the logistics of being near Baghdad, and I think, frankly, there was a lot of inertia. What happened was they came in and they saw what was a prison designed according to American plans. The Abu Ghraib prison was built on American and British plans in the 60s, and they said, this is a real prison. We can use it. It's here.
My guest is Philip Gurevich, who is the editor of the Paris Review, longtime staff writer for The New Yorker. You may have seen an abbreviated version of the book that we are discussing, Standard Operating Procedure, in The New Yorker, written at least on the cover by Philip Gurevich and Errol Morris, actually written by Philip Gurevich based on lots of interviews, fabulous interviews by Errol Morris. The book is published by the Penguin Press. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Philip Gurevich, whose latest book is Standard Operating Procedure, published by the Penguin Press. Philip, do you think that what happened at Abu Ghraib was unique to this war? Because I have read about prisoner abuses during World War II, including waterboarding in the Philippines. We've discussed books about the massacres of civilians in Korea and Vietnam. So isn't this just something that we might expect when soldiers are put into extremely stressful situations?
Well, yes and no. You might expect that when you get into a war, awfully ugly things are going to happen and atrocities will be committed here and there, sometimes with more deliberateness and sometimes with more heat of passion, I suppose you could call it.
Like Haditha, for example.
Yeah, but people often say, isn't Haditha worse? There are people massacred, and civilians massacred and so forth in cold blood. And I think no, because in a Haditha, you had what we were told you had at Abu Ghraib, which was rogue soldiers. You had a cover-up, too, by some of their higher-ups, but you had basically individual soldiers acting as individuals run amok. At Abu Ghraib, what distinguishes Abu Ghraib and distinguishes the entire policy of prisoner abuse in the war on terror.
Because of Afghanistan as well. There was a documentary, Taxi to the Dark Side, which is about a similar kind of situation
in Afghanistan. The context here is the war on terror, and Afghanistan is the same theater in that respect. Here it was the policy. And that's a change from all the dirty tricks and misdeeds and aberrations or excesses on what Dick Cheney calls the dark side in the past, which is that in the past, the dark side was meant to be dark. It was meant to be clandestine. It was meant to be criminal. Here, you had it becoming the policy to the extent that you're actually sending soldiers who are not read into dark secret things, but who are just ordinary MP reservists are implementing this as standard procedure.
So since you mentioned Vice President Cheney, what role does he and his legal counsel, David Addington, play in all of this? Were they the prime movers in trying to reconfigure the Geneva Conventions?
Well, they were prime movers, not necessarily the prime movers. There was a group of people who in the administration who've been identified in this story, although a version of it I have in the book is not the centerpiece of the book, the policy, but you can trace it quite clearly from the immediate aftermath of September 11th. Dick Cheney and his counsel, David Addington, George Bush and his then White House counsel, Gonzales, who then, of course, became Attorney General, and Rumsfeld at his end of the military spectrum at the Pentagon. At the Justice Department, you had primarily legal advisors, John Yoo being the most prominent, a man named Bybee, who he was also signing off on these memos, all basically looking at the same thing, which is, do we really have to abide by the Geneva Conventions, which create a regime of protections for people in our custody? And if we decide that we don't, which they decided pretty quickly, and these are merely legal opinions, but they were the ones they were going to be guided by, if we don't, what is allowed? What can we do? How far can we go? And they started de-defining torture, defining it in a sense out of existence as constituting requiring a level of intention and a level of pain that you could never prove in court. They started showing holes in the Geneva Conventions and then claiming that the conventions didn't apply. And there's a really critical moment when all of this pivots in the Iraq War, and that is that the Geneva Conventions' protections for what we call prisoners of war, in the traditional sense, POWs, apply primarily to wars between states. I, the king, and you, the king, are fighting each other with our armies. When we get to the point where I've wiped out the king and his army, who's fighting me? Well, the army's supposed to go home. They have no political master. They're done. They're no longer a threat. You release the prisoners. That's the rules, and that's the way it works. And you treat POWs quite well. You basically treat them as an enemy asset that's been neutralized, not as a war criminal.
Or you debathify them.
Yeah, but you remove them behind the lines, and that's the rule. On May 1, 2003, we all know there was the famous speech on the aircraft carrier when President Bush gets out there and says, mission accomplished, and declares the end of major combat. All of our attention was focused on the aspect of that speech which really was the premature triumphalism and showbiz of the thing and the sort of campaign stuntsmanship. But behind that, the tail of the speech, the two-thirds of the speech that was real substance, he was folding that war. No longer was he talking about Iraq. He was talking about the war on terror. He was talking about Al-Qaeda. He was talking about September 11th. He wasn't talking about Saddam Hussein.
So
and he was folding it in, and there was a legal context for that. After that, those prisoners became more like the Afghan prisoners. They became security detainees, not prisoners of war, and they started to be denied rights.
So just because the Geneva Conventions don't say security detainees, they were kept to a different standard?
Well, you start having a fudging of categories. What you have is, in Afghanistan, they declared that Geneva doesn't apply. In Iraq, they say Geneva does apply, but then these people were classifying as we did those people in Afghanistan, and so maybe that doesn't apply. And many of the people who are serving, you have to remember, have been given rules in Afghanistan. They're bringing these contexts together and collapsing them.
Well, but we also have redefinitions of what is torture and what is not torture.
Correct.
Why did the two most common weapons of interrogation become dogs and sexual humiliation?
Well, there were these behavioral scientists in the Army, Army psychologists and anthropologists, who put out these papers on the Arab mind, which really read like Victorian race science that the colonialists would take into, you know, countries and just describe who's superior and inferior and how their size of their nose defines that. It would say, well, Arabs are unusually, they're fearful of dogs. And also, Arab men don't like to be stripped naked and laughed at by women who are their captors.
Well, I don't like a dog menacing me.
Well, nevertheless, this is an Arab thing. Seriously, it sounds quite absurd, and it is kind of absurd when you read these papers sounding pseudoscientific. But the idea was, we can't, if we're trying not to torture people, which means inflict physical pain on them, if we're trying not to leave marks, how can we make them miserable and make them suffer and break down their resistance to us and do things to them that they want us to stop so they'll talk and give us information? Well, we strip them naked, and you'll be notice, Leonard, that nobody has ever been held accountable for keeping prisoners naked, which is in violation of every single possible code of conduct. Nobody has ever been held liable for keeping them bound in stress positions and with panties on their heads for long periods in dark cells. Those things became invisible, even despite the photographs.
My guest is Philip Gurevich, who's written with source material from Errol Morris' Standard Operating Procedure. It's published by the Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Who was doing the interrogations? That wasn't people like Lindy England, was it?
No, they were guards. And normally in a prison is run by military police. These were not military police unit who were trained as guards. They were trained actually as convoy operators and combat support teams. They were brought to Abu Ghraib and suddenly put as guards in charge of the highest value detainees in the country, which shows a level of neglect. I mean, if these are important prisoners, presumably you'd put capable guards. But one of the reasons I think that they were willing to put them there is that the whole design of the interrogation process at Abu Ghraib was to put the military interrogators in charge of the MPs rather than the MPs in charge of the prisoners. And they took their instruction from them. And it was a very confusing group. There were military intelligence officers. There were civilian contractors who were working without military standing but as part of the military intelligence team. Most of them were military intelligence vets who had then been hired as civilians. There were CIA agents. At one time, as many as one quarter of the prisoners on the military intelligence cell block were held as what was known as OGA, meaning other government agencies, which is a euphemism and an acronym for the acronym of CIA. But it can also mean FBI or Defense Intelligence Agency or Task Force 121 or so, a lot of these other clandestine groups. All of them were sharing space there, and they had different sets of rules, and they worked in the dark.
But it seems to me that what happened was that one or the other or all of them decided that these MPs, who weren't really MPs, should move from a monitoring role to actually getting involved on a physical level with soften them up.
Condition setting. And that's very explicit. What happens is...
And did they tell them, you should do this?
You should do this. And they were told that they should be asking them to do this. What happened was basically that Jeffrey Miller, who was the general in charge of Guantanamo Bay, and he was using these rather relaxed or permissive rules that Rumsfeld had signed off on. He was brought over in the early fall of 2003, right after Labor Day, and he brought his rules with him and gave them to General Sanchez and said, you should make your rules based on these for Abu Ghraib.
Because then, they were concerned that they weren't getting enough real intelligence.
Yeah, they really wanted to ramp things up. They wanted to gitmoize was the expression that they were using. But they also had a woman there, Carolyn Wood, who had been at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan during the time when a couple of prisoners were killed because of the practices there. She brought in also very lax rules. They combined these rules, created the rules for Abu Ghraib, and very explicitly in the rules Sanchez signs, it says interrogators should be in charge of all conditions and MPs should be implementing them. General Miller said, They should be setting the conditions for successful exploitation of the interrogation. And so you had these handlers, this mixture of MI and CIA and civilian contractors, none of whom, by the way, wore identifying tags. They would come in with what they called sterile uniforms, no rank, no identifying, no name. And the MPs were told, do what they tell you. And they would come in and say, keep this one up all night. Some of it was in writing, and we've seen some of that. But most of it was by insinuation and suggestion.
And you write, lawlessness became the law.
Yeah, Megan Ambule, one of the specialists who was there, she was in charge. The women and children were kept on the same cell block on the other side of the tier, and she was always there at night for them. And she, at one point, said, nobody could... I started to realize that they could never say we broke the rules because there were no rules.
But you suggest that the man on the box with the electrical wires or the panties on the head, that was actually standard operating procedure, the title of the book.
It was. In the case of the man on the box, he had been brought in by the Criminal Investigative Division of the Army, the people who later investigated the photographs and the scandal and whose investigation was the core of it. They were intimately involved in the abuses on the place, even though they later became the investigators. So they brought him in and they said, give him hell. And this was keeping him up and trying to break him to identify himself by name. And it turned out he wasn't even the right guy.
Well, we see some dead bodies in these photographs.
We see one, certainly.
Al-Jamadi?
Mondo Al-Jamadi.
Who was he killed by? I mean, if we use the word killed. How did he
well,
die?
Well, the Army classified his death as a homicide, which occurred during an interrogation at Abu Ghraib. He was under interrogation by a CIA interrogator. He was brought in on the morning of, I believe it was November 4th, 2003, a pretty early morning, just before the day shift began, as the day shift began. And he had been captured by Navy SEALs. He was suspected of being a bomb maker, or a bomb procurer for blowing up the Red Cross building, I think it was, in Baghdad. And he was brought in, and after a couple of hours, he was dead in his cell. There are a couple of MPs whose story, who each tell their involvement in this in the way that I recount it, and they were called in and out of the cell at times by the interrogator saying, hoist him higher. They put him in a position called a Palestinian hanging. And it was during that time that he died. The exact cause of his death, whether he was being beaten in that cell, it's not entirely clear. But he was very, very banged up when they took his hood off and he was bleeding.
Well, since it was called a homicide, why hasn't anybody been charged with it?
Well, Jane Mayer reported in The New Yorker perhaps about a year and a half ago, the name of the CIA agent, Swanner. He'd been identified. He's living in Virginia. The thing is stalled. There are layers and layers of protection and obscurantism that have been created in this war on terror to protect people who are involved in these interrogations. And the only person who's been punished and prosecuted for that are the MPs who took the photographs and for taking the photographs. They actually initially charged Sabrina Harmon, who had been training to be a forensic photographer before she joined the Army. And when she saw the body 16 hours after it died on ice in a shower in a body bag, she peeled back the bandages that had been placed on it after its death to make it look like he'd had treatment for his wounds prior to his death, which was not true.
She was looking for evidence.
She took these extraordinary photographs. She was prosecuted or charged initially. They didn't prosecute her in the end for altering evidence and tampering with the dead.
Whose decision was it to declare a 48-hour amnesty when the military superiors learned about
this? This was an extraordinary thing. The photographs started to be investigated in mid-January of 2004, so 3 months after they started to be taken. The Criminal Investigative Division opens a dossier and decides, and they immediately seize the people we now know as the Bad Apples. At the same time, Colonel Pappas, who was the head of military intelligence at the prison and was also, in an extraordinary move, he had been named by Sanchez the commander of the prison. They'd removed the MP commander and put him in charge of the whole prison. He issued a general amnesty order. And it was apparently this is something that periodically happens at large bases, that the commander will put out a thing saying, look, all the things that we mention in general order number one, which is the basic rule for GIs in a theater, no booze, no porn, no contraband, no antiquities, no, this, that, and the other thing. You can take these things and put them in an amnesty box, and they put these things that look like mailboxes all around, and no offense, no foul. Afterwards, we'll have an inspection, and if you don't have anything on you, no problem. Listed in the middle of that list suddenly and jarringly different language. It says, according to the Geneva Convention, any photographs of prisoners must be, you know, can be turned in. And so it was basically, suddenly, as the rumors are going around, there's an investigation, out comes this order from the commander saying, destroy all the evidence. And over from the next 48 hours, people were wiping their hard drives, scrubbing their computers. There were bonfires as people burned everything. And
so a lot of evidence was destroyed.
By all accounts.
And Pappas and Miller have never been charged with anything either. In fact, no one above the level of staff sergeant has served any jail time for Abu Ghraib. Are most of them out of jail now other than Charles Greener?
Charles Greener is the only one who remains in jail. He got a 10-year sentence.
Do you think that the way the Abu Ghraib abuses are remembered will change over the years as the war in Iraq is reevaluated?
Oh, I do. I think that that's an excellent question. The question is how. And I think, you know, that originally we all shared in the embarrassment that there was a sense of revulsion and there was a sense we're caught inside something that's still going on and it's very hard to assess it. I think as we look at it over time, we will start to see the command responsibility element. I hope that we will start to see that this really is a question of how we're asking our young men and women sent there in the name of our freedom and our security to behave and evaluate whether this is what we want to be doing.
But will we have to deal with these atrocities the way the West Germans or the Japanese had to, although they've had different responses, deal with what happened after World War II with maybe what the Russians have had to deal with the gulags?
Within our system, it's so unlikely because all of those cases that you're talking about involved the total delegitimation of a regime and its collapse. And it was in the aftermath of that that some leaders were held accountable. But it is striking that when you look at the models that have evolved over the years for such situations, for large-scale crimes committed by agents of the state at the orders of the state, in Rwanda, for instance, the decision was made that the ordinary peasant hatchet man, even though they may have killed more than the man who gave the orders and designed the system at the top of the order, should be held to a lower level of accountability than the political masterminds. And that is how the legal thinking goes elsewhere. Here we've seen the opposite. And frankly, in a sort of Frank Capra movie way, it's as deeply un-American as the offenses themselves that it's the little guys who've been held out to hang.
Our listeners can also hear the interview I did with Errol Morris by going to our show page. It's instructive to see the film and then read the book or read the book and then see the film because they do not cancel each other out. If anything, they just amplify our understanding of what happened at Abu Ghraib in a way that no one can ever imagine. I hope that they cause an immediate reevaluation. My great thanks to Philip Gurevich, who has written Standard Operating Procedure, published by the Penguin Press.
Thank you, Leonard.